Today, Voices from Oxford is talking to James Martin. James Martin is famous for very many, many reasons, and the first is the development of modern computers. I remember the days 50 years ago when a computer was just a huge collection of valves in a big box. We're also in the year in which we're celebrating 100 years of Alan Turing, one of the great founders of the theory of computers. James Martin is also one of the great contributors to the development of modern computing. And in recent years, he has been exploring the questions that arise as a consequence of the bringing together of humanity and computers. The other reason why James Martin is famous is that here in Oxford he has founded the Martin School, which is itself a highly interdisciplinary venture. And I think I'm right in saying, Jim, that to some extent the ideas for that are in your book, The 21st Century, and I want really to start with some questions to do with that. Okay. And the first, and obviously very big question is, are we going to survive the 21st century?
Yes, we are going to survive the 21st century. Now, there may be terrible things that happen, so when you say, are we going to survive, it may be only 1% of us will survive. But the military, for example, now are finding all sorts of ways that if the very worst happens, a lot of people will survive. Yeah. There are deep holes in the ground with all sorts of facilities at the bottom. The nuclear submarines have got food. A nuclear submarine has enough power to keep going for 15 years. So if there was a terrible world war, you'd have the nuclear submarines heading to some safe place in the southern hemisphere, possibly going to the Antarctic. So there's no question in my mind that Homo sapiens will survive.
Right.
But it might be an awful lot of, you know, 3 years, 30 years from now, a new word may be in our vocabulary, a gigafamine.
Mm-hmm. So you're a mixture there, aren't you? Because if I ask you the question, are you basically an optimist about the 21st century? There's part of you that says yes, but there's also part of you saying this could be a very, very tragic century too.
Well, I don't think of myself as either an optimist or a pessimist. I like to think of myself as more like an engineer in which there are huge problems to be solved. And if we use the very best professionals and we can solve them, you might imagine Earth as being like a ship which is heading into a hurricane and nobody's reading the instruments at the present time.
Right.
If they did read the instruments and took all the right actions, they could bypass the hurricane and be fine. But we are asking for trouble. We're heading right into an era where we could destroy the climate, for example.
Yes.
Or we could have a new type of nuclear war or nuclear terrorism.
Sure.
So it's a set of engineering problems. If we take those things seriously, we have solutions to them.
Right.
And if there are solutions, then the 21st century is going to be wonderful. But the big danger is most of the public are not doing that. The media are not doing it.
No.
Most of the scientists on television are buffoon scientists, not real scientists.
That's an interesting question, yes. But now I come to some of the scientific questions that I want to put to you, because as I said in my introduction, you have been extremely influential in the development of computing. And I think also you have some fairly radical and revolutionary ideas on the way in which computers and humans are going to interact. Could I ask you to elaborate on that?
Well, in a sense, we're at the beginning of computing, because we haven't really made artificial intelligence do much that is interesting, but we certainly will in the next 20 years. And that coincides with the beginning of robotics. The military want to buy enormous numbers of very different types of robots, none of them looking anything like the robots on television.
Yeah.
And so those two things, again, fundamentally change employment. At the same time, we are outsourcing much employment to China or to India. And so it's interesting to ask the question. We're outsourcing the simple stuff, and the difficult stuff is going to be done by machines. Where is employment going to come from in
yes.
the Western world? And
yes.
ultimately, we're going to move to a condition where I think there will have to be far more leisure time than there is today, because machines are going to do so much of the work.
Are going to be doing so much.
And so that raises a question. Yes. How do you bring up people so that they are really going to have good lives and use their leisure time very well? Right. And in most universities, they're forgetting about the humanities. There was a lecture here called the Bonfire of the Humanities. And that is not what we want at the moment. We want to teach people how to have a good life, even though automation has become spectacular.
I want to come back to the humanities just a little bit later, but I first want to ask you one or two questions of a technical nature about computing. Now, a philosophical question. Can a computer think?
I don't think we really know how to define the word think.
Right.
A computer can handle huge amounts of data and do enormously complex logic. Is that thinking? And certainly a computer can do that much better than we can.
Right.
But humans have an intuition, a capability to put many subtle ideas together in very complex ways, and computers cannot do that yet.
Right.
So it may be a long time before they can.
Yes, right. So do you see an interface developing between humans and computing?
Yeah.
Because to some extent, what you just said implies that the computer is a kind of tool. It can do the logical things for us very much faster than we can, but it doesn't have, as you say, the intuitive understanding. And so could a combination of the two, somehow linking computers and humanity together, be the way forward?
Well, I think it's very lucky that computer intelligence is nothing like human intelligence.
Right.
So human intelligence will move into doing better the things which humans are very good at.
Yes.
And there are many things which humans are not very good at, but which machines are good at.
Yes.
So they're going to get this combination of brilliant human intuition and skills and wisdom combined to enormous processing power and the capability to collect data from everywhere simultaneously.
Yes.
Massive amounts of fashionable word now is big data. So just enormous quantities of data.
Right.
So the combination of what humans do well and what computers do well is spectacular and will change the whole future of civilization.
Yes. You talk in your books about what you call the singularity. Can you say what that is and how you conceive it?
Well, the singularity has become a sort of almost stupid word, because people are saying that computers are going to get more intelligent than humans, and then computers are going to say, why do we need humans? They're idiots, and let's get rid of the humans. So I would not use the word singularity, because it's become associated with things which are science fiction.
Oh, okay, yes, I
but
understand.
I would replace it by saying we are going to move into a time when computers are immensely powerful, immensely intelligent.
Yes.
They've got the capability to look at all the data of the planet. And how does that relate to what humans do well? And that's a very complex and answerable question.
Indeed, yes. I sometimes, as a way of explaining my own way as a biologist and a computer person too, one of the ways in which I explain the difficulty of imagining a computer completely replacing a human is to ask the question, how many possible interactions, how many possible processes could there be inside this box, one's head?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as we well know, the total number of neurons involved there is simply phenomenally large, and if you add all the synapses to the neurons as well, with thousands of synapses per neuron, well, you end up with numbers of possible interactions that are so big, there wouldn't be enough stuff in the universe to represent all of that. Now, that could be used as an argument for saying that there must be a sort of limit to the extent to which you could replace all of this by computation. Would you agree with that, or do you think that's being a little bit too human-oriented?
Well, the reason why we can replace it spectacularly is because when you think, you're thinking at chemical speeds.
Yes.
And chemical speeds are very, very slow indeed.
Indeed so, yes.
Whereas electronics are moving into very high speeds. I was reading a paper this morning which was talking about, you know, we talk about absolute zero.
Yes.
We used to think 1 degree Kelvin is the lowest temperature you can get. And they now are doing experiments which are 1/10,000th of a degree Kelvin.
Right.
And we have similar things in speed, so very, very short pulses, extreme speed.
Yes.
That is immensely more powerful than biology.
Yes, yes. And, of course, there's also the possibility of using quantum effects in computing, which could also greatly speed up the way in which things are done.
I think we're on the brink of something very extraordinary with quantum technology, yes, that I think very few people, even very few scientists, have realized yet.
Yes.
That is that the leading quantum people are now saying that space and time are not fundamental variables, which sounds outrageous to say. The fundamental variables are quantum entanglement, and the whole universe is quantum entangled, and
yes,
that space and time are a consequence of quantum entanglement. So quantum computing is heading into some very strange areas these days.
Yes, yes. Now I want to return to, you were saying earlier on that as computers replace some of our mundane tasks, that humanity will have to adapt to, how should I best put this, to find ways of enjoying itself, finding ways of leisure. Now, that links to the question of the humanities, doesn't it?
Yes.
Because the aspect of any interdisciplinary work, and universities should, in principle, be very, very good at that, leads to an obvious question. Do you think there's a sense in which the humanities and the sciences have become divorced from each other, and should they reconnect?
Well, they are a bit divorced at the moment, but they shouldn't be, I think. All right. Human knowledge ought to really be integrated.
Yes. So that if we come back to the question of the way in which humanity might develop in the... well, let's assume we survive the 21st century and we have extremely powerful computational facilities that replace most of the mundane tasks, leaving us as humans to be the more intuitive, creative, perhaps, parts of the universe. That is going to require a very different attitude to the humanities from that which many scientists have, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether I'm being unfair here, but I find quite a lot of my colleagues a little bit dismissive, if you like, of what the humanities can contribute. But I sense that you're not in that category.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And I think when we put the two together, it becomes very exciting. Take the theatre, for example.
Yes.
England has had Shakespeare, it's got the Royal Shakespeare Company, which is the best theatre company in the world.
Yes.
When you ask, what will technology do to theatre? Well, you can imagine a theatre which has something like an IMAX screen,
right,
where you can change the scenery constantly, and the scenery is digital. You can create any effect you want, and then you put the actors into there. So we have the capability to make the theatre much grander, more spectacular, more overwhelming to the audience.
Yes.
And I think everywhere you look in the humanities, the impact of using technology is going to enable them to do new things, which are very inventive.
Right. So you see that kind of interaction, that, as it were, the developments of technology become a tool that the humanities can use.
Yes, but having said that, we are teaching English so we can use it when we write scientific papers and Rupert Murdoch's papers and things like that.
Right.
We really ought to be eventually taking people back to beautiful English, the English that this country's handled so well in the past, so that we can, a very important part of the humanities is to create literature which is wonderful.
Yes, yes. I want to take you back now to technological developments. You refer, I think, in your books to something you call artilects. I think artificial intellectual objects, is that a good way to describe it? Well, how do you think of that?
Well, we have many different intellects looking at very different subjects.
Right.
Many of those intellects are going to become automated or partially automated.
Yes.
So you will have a world in which there are many intellects with a very high artificial intelligence component and a large component of huge memory, global memory, and so on.
Yes.
And so I like to call those artilects, artificial intellects.
Right, yes. You refer to them as the cathedrals of the 21st century. Your metaphor there is that these are the developments that rather like the 200 years that it would take to build a cathedral, an immense and extraordinary and beautiful object of construction. Is your metaphor here to indicate that in developing technical facilities of this kind, we are, as it were, also creating cathedrals in that metaphorical sense?
a very extraordinary thing happened at the end of the Dark Ages, and that is for some strange reason you've got towns like Chatre, where everybody in the town for more than a century was building the cathedral.
Exactly,
and,
yes.
The architect knew that he would never live to see the finished cathedral because it would take 100 years to build.
Yes.
But it was everybody's attention going into the same thing. Now suppose you had that intensity of right. human intention, human skill going into the things which are part of our future now.
Yes.
So you might ask the question, what will be the cathedrals of the future? Not cathedrals of stone and glass.
Right. The cathedrals of the mind,
yes.
and partly minds that we create.
Yes.
Is that a good way to put it?
Yes, yes.
Yes, yes. Now, it leads me to the last question that I wanted to put to you. I think you refer also in your book to what you see as a, well, again, using a metaphor, you call it a Copernican revolution in religion. Now, just as it were, to make sure that the listeners to this discussion can see what we're getting at here, the Copernican revolution, of course, was a revolution in understanding of the stars and the relation of the sun to the earth and so on, and a big flip, if you like, in the way in which the earth was viewed, first as the centre of the universe and then just as a tiny planet wandering around, a small star in a very tiny part of a big galaxy, which is part of an even bigger universe with God knows how many billions of galaxies. So, huge revolution. So if you're talking of a Copernican revolution in relation to religion, you must be also imagining that there will be a big flip. Is that what you see?
Well, not quite a big flip. I think if you look at what we, scientists know today, what we should be teaching to children, we have planet Earth that's totally isolated. The nearest planet that could have intelligent creatures is probably 10 trillion miles away.
Yes.
So absolutely isolated, absolutely alone.
Yeah.
But we're in a galaxy that has got 100 billion stars, many of them with planets, probably with intelligent people. We're in a universe in which there are 100 billion galaxies.
Our
brain has got 100 billion neurons. This is a number which turns up quite a lot of these days.
Sure. That's
now, you look at the complexity of quantum technology and the complexity of the things which are happening in most of the sciences today.
Yes.
And this is absolutely awesome. We cannot possibly understand it completely. So out there, there are huge mysteries which the human mind cannot grapple with yet.
Yes.
I always like it when Martin Rees says that his dog can't understand quantum mechanics. And in a similar way, our brain won't be able to understand the great mysteries which are out there.
Right.
Now, you take that world of great mysteries and say, in that world, what do we mean by God?
Yes, indeed, yes.
And it's an interesting question.
Yes.
It's a question which is very different from when Jesus Christ was alive.
Yes. So what you're seeing there, then, as a revolution is what it is that our scientific understanding of where we are and the sheer immensity of the universe has produced in us as contemplating this situation, and as you say, forcing us to deep questions like, what do we mean by God? And that's what you mean by a Copernican revolution, is that right?
Yes,
yes. Well, James Martin, thank you very much for talking to Voices from Oxford.
Well, thank you very much.